are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 2nd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Director of New Models of Change at the New America Foundation, Heather Hurlburt. On Obama's flawed foreign policy. Also on the program today, Think Progress Justice editor Ian Millhiser. On what are we calling him? The Freedom Fascist? What was his magazine?
Fascism Forever.
Oh, the Fascism Forever.
Not Freedom Fascist. Just New Forever Fascism. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, get
the
it right.
Forever huh? Fascism of Neil Gorsuch.
Wow, look at
actually
Gorsuch.
We recorded that interview before the that story about the fascism came out. We'll talk about that later in the program.
Like a safari club?
Betsy DeVos's confirmation down to the wire. It's 50-50, supposedly. Trump's Yemeni raid that supposedly killed 14 combatants also killed an unnamed number of women and children and could be the precursor of a wider conflict in Yemen. Trump administration calls for less scrutiny on violent white supremacists in this country. And in New York City, Yemeni Americans are planning a massive bodega strike to protest the Muslim ban. Trump reportedly threatens to invade Mexico and then causes a diplomatic row with Australia, which, of course, just follows the old Clinton playbook. This all happened in the past 24 hours. And Lawlessness Watch streams now with more coal poisons. Oil and gas companies no longer have to report their bribes to foreign countries. And prisoners will be fleeced if they want to call their loved ones.
That was Hillary's plan.
All that and more on today's program. I don't know what to tell you, folks. Welcome to the new normal. I mean, things will slow down. I imagine when they cut off our internet usage in the internment camps, we're going to have a much simpler show.
You'll know a lot less when the information's circulating less freely.
That's what Gorsuch said
to me. I didn't know that he was a big league fascist. Look, I thought Pence just wanted him so that like gay people would literally go back to closets.
Everybody has no just got to find that one thing that they can do every day that just takes them out of this. Not all day, but just like for a certain period of time.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think you're kind of in
me,
it.
For me, it's I just really sit down and immerse myself in a good Twitter fight that is instigated by someone saying something positive about Jimmy Dore.
Me, it's getting into a rabbit hole of Frederick Douglass jokes and memes. That's my happy place.
Just a couple of things off the top. Corrections from the yesterday's show. And this was all, I think, mostly in the fun half. But I just wanted to make clear that the report we did from a Michigan television program about a man who claimed his mom died in Iraq after the Trump ban was instituted, lied. This is according to his imam. Also, it is unclear whether or not the voice that we heard on that hot mic was Paul Ryan's complaining about the waste of time. and swearing. So that's get that out of the way. Also, that was Tuesday, I guess. Also, I should say, on Tuesday, I spoke about that Seth Franson piece that was totally misguided on claiming that the Trump ban was based on an Obama law. And just to be clear, and at the time I was like, well, you know, it was a response to an emailer who was like, sent me this piece and didn't really do any digging into it. And then, of course, last night I found out where this piece was getting widely disseminated, on a Jimmy Dore video. And so I'm going to walk through this again for people who are too moronic to actually do their own reading when they do a YouTube show, or are just so craven that they'll just stop doing the slightest bit of research when it confirms their business model. In 2015, Republicans pushed in the House a bill which would force citizens of one of, I think it was 34 countries, European countries, Japan, Korea, maybe a couple others, who are accepted from the visa requirements that we impose on the rest of whatever, 190 countries in the world. And they said, if you travel to one of these seven countries, you're going and enter the United States from these countries, you do not have the privilege of entering this country without a visa. You're going to have a visa. This was a Republican bill that was pushed in Congress. I guess they couldn't get it through the Senate, so they stuck it in the omnibus bill of 2015, the budget bill. Obama signed the entire bill, which involved probably hundreds of provisions, ranging from God knows what to God knows what. Does Obama have responsibility for signing that? Yes. The fact that Donald Trump chose those seven countries that were designated under that bill to impose a religious ban on Muslims. And again, let me explain how that happens. When you have seven Muslim-majority countries and you say everyone is banned from these countries from entering into this into our country except for religious minorities in those countries, you know who's going to be banned. Muslims. So to say that this is Barack Obama's, or he laid even the framework for this, is absurd. It's like saying when Donald Trump calls and gets into an argument with the prime minister from Australia, Barack Obama set up the framework when he established this whole thing where you call other world leaders.
If you don't send us more illegal Syrians who haven't been vetted, we're going to have a serious problem, Australia.
So to go out and to promulgate this is just the height of stupidity, or like I say, just cravenness because it fits your business model. So congratulations if you get hundreds of thousands of video hits on it. And if you have the ability to look at yourself in the mirror and still think what you're doing is actually not deceitful. And if anybody has a problem with me talking about it or tweeting about it, then bye. I don't give a shit. I don't know what Jimmy's politics are, but I know where his integrity level is, and it's very, very low. Because anytime you question him on this stuff, he just comes back with, I'm a comedian. So for some reason, he's not held up in his own mind to any standards of having to do any work or whatever it is. For him, it's just a business. Or God knows what else is driving it. So,
Sherry's Berries.
Maybe I'm just so cranky because I'm staring at that Sherry's Berries box over there and I'm starving.
It's
and
true.
I'm already anticipating the moment where I'm going to eat all of them. And
I'm going to leave the room with the box right now. Have a good show, everyone.
Don't do that. Could there possibly be a better Valentine's Day gift than Sherry's Berries?
That's why I'm taking it.
No, of course not. This is it, man. I have found the this is the entire enchilada, as it were. Nikki's birthday and Valentine's Day. Boom. Oh my God. How would you like some Sherry's Berries?
It's a Sherry's Berries box. Now I gotta go read Social Security reports and tirade on Twitter. Love you very much.
I feel like I could get away with it. I brought her home one of those strawberries before that are dipped in
those
chocolate.
Those are so good,
and
man.
Honestly, like she was still talking about it for like 2 days
They're
later.
Insane.
Freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries starting at just $19.99 plus shipping, or you can double the berries for just $10 more. Just go to berries.com and use my code CEDAR, spelled like Seder, S-E-D-E-R. You can help support this show by supporting our sponsors. Use my code CEDAR, S-E-D-E-R. I've talked about these strawberries before. They're fresh, they're juicy, they're sweet. They're so big, you can actually share them. Like you could actually share them. They're dipped in white chocolate, milk chocolate, dark chocolate. Oh, my God.
Steve doesn't like the other ones.
Some with chocolate chips, decorative swizzles. I can barely... Honestly, like
it's actually disgusting from the side. You're literally,
I know, I
you're
can't.
Like teething.
I'm already Jesus. Just like, I'm starting to feel weak. I'm going to pass out. With Valentine's Day right around the corner, there's only one way to get Sherry's Berries starting at $19.99. Just visit berries.com, berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in CEDAR. S-E-D-E-R. That's berries.com. Use my code CEDAR. Help support the show by basically making your Valentine have one of the best Valentines ever.
Give yourself a big win.
Exactly.
And you don't have to go out to the store or anything.
I know. This is it's my favorite. It's got
a
everything
great
present. I want. And for that matter, with Valentine's Day come up, you want to give a huge gift, one that's going to blow their socks off? I mean, I don't know if you say socks for watch. Their ankles off. People wear ankle watches, don't they? No? I don't know. Movement Watches was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. It was started by two broke college kids who wanted to wear stylish watches, but they couldn't afford them. And then they just, bit by bit, not unlike we did on this program, they built a business because of word of mouth and the quality of their product. They sell their products entirely online. Movement was able to cut out the middleman, cut out the retail markup, provide you with the best possible price. Watches starting at just $95. That's a fraction of what department store brands typically charge. This revolutionary pricing, along with the product's classic design, quality construction, styled minimalism, has led over to over 500,000 watches being sold in over 160 countries. I got Nikki one of these. She has been getting compliments regularly. I don't know how she meets so many different new people all the time.
Why are you all over? Another person said it was a nice watch.
I just see the same three people every day. If I had a watch, I'd get one compliment. That would be the end of it.
And one not compliment.
So step up your watch game and see why people across the world love Movement Watches. Just go to movementwatches.com/majority. Get 15% off today, plus with free shipping and free returns. Grab one for your Valentine before it's too late. That's MVMTWatches.com. MVMTWatches.com/majority. Join the movement.
I feel like the combination of Sherry's Berries And a movement watch, depending on where you are in your relationship, is a perfect Valentine's Day gift for not a lot of money. And you don't have to go anywhere, and you can...
It's true.
Have a watch and some chocolate, see?
And Matt, it's also a great way to just ghost from the relationship.
That, yeah.
You're a bunch of bears.
I think this is a similarity that Matt and I have. If you get an exceptionally nice Valentine's, goodbye.
Then you can just go. And... And
just
look,
send it to their house.
Yeah, exactly.
And I have.
Did you get the Sherry's berries? All right, then delete
you leave
my
on
number.
A high note. And here is, I can do the trifecta for you. Here's where you go. You're tired of the cold. You're tired of the bleak weather. Escape the freezing temperatures and take the trip to the white sandy beaches, the Pineapple Beach Club in Antigua.
I got you Sherry's berries, and my friend Matt and I are going to the Pineapple Club right. together.
Right. Oh, my God. I'm going to do this whole thing today. I'm doing the whole...
I want to go there so
much. Oh, my God. $149 per person per night. It's an amazing, all-inclusive... Adults only, no children under the age of like 16 or 17, I guess. Getaway comes at a more, even more amazing price. You get $250 resort credit. Use that for sailing trips, dining, safari tours, spa services, gifts. Just go to pineapplebeachclub.com to make your reservation today. Head over there, honestly. Take a look at the picture of Antigua. Oh, my God. The resort encompasses 30 acres of tropical foliage and panoramic vistas. Plus, it's all-inclusive. So your meals, snacks, beverages, alcohol too, water sports, daily entertainment, even taxes and gratuity are all covered. Oh, my God. So leave the... Exactly. Leave the frosty weather behind. Take the vacation you deserve. Don't wait. This offer expires soon, and now's the time to go. It's February, man. Go to pineapplebeachclub.com or call 800-772-8711 to book your all-inclusive stay. $149 per night, per person. You can enjoy everything I mentioned and more, and you'll get a $250 resort credit. That's pineapplebeachclub.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Heather Hurlburt on Obama's flawed foreign policy, and then we will... play that interview I did with Ian Millhiser from yesterday on Gorsuch, the Supreme Court pick. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program The director of the New Models of Change at the New America Foundation, Heather Hurlburt. Heather, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be with you.
Okay, we can hear you. We can hear you fine. We had a little issues. I don't know. So it happens. Heather, all right. So let's. I want to dig into this piece that you wrote in Democracy Journal, because we have already at a pace far quicker than I imagine most people anticipated, moved into a radically different era of foreign policy, which, for all we can tell at this point, involves a sea war with China over their islands, a possible ground invasion of Mexico, and who knows what with Australia, just to begin. But let's go back and look at Obama's legacy, because we may completely forget that he existed in a matter of months. So give us a sense of just, let's start with just this. Like, what constitutes foreign policy writ large? Just so we have a notion, because I think there's a tendency to assume that it's just national security, very narrow sort of militaristic issues.
So the idea that American presidents up to now pursued was that the U.S. has a whole range of interests that lie outside our shores, and that you have a foreign policy to deal with that whole range of everything that happens outside the U.S. that yet affects the interests of the U.S. as a country and the people who live here. So, you know, there is, for example, the theory that global warming is a bad thing because it affects us here, and therefore you want to try to work cooperatively and internationally since the pesky climate refuses to respect national borders. Or, for example, that, you know, Ebola, disease, AIDS, another thing that, you know, sort of annoyingly doesn't really care if you build a wall to keep it out, and therefore you're going to need to put some time and energy into combating it in other places in order that it not come here right across the wall that you build and harm your citizens. So, you know, a traditional construct of foreign policy is very broad. And, you know, we in the commentariat and the media, Sam, have a lot to do with that. We don't talk as much about the parts of it that aren't about guns and starting wars or threatening wars. So, you know, we do tend, and this was true under Obama as under his predecessors, to ignore the other parts of foreign policy. You know, what you're alluding to is that the Trump folks have actually been very explicit in their transition documents and questionnaires they gave the department that they're not really sure anything that doesn't have to do with hard security is valuable, frankly. That they take a view that, you know, maybe, I'm not sure whether they think the market will take care of disease or whether they really think that a wall will keep out disease or that a refugee ban will keep out disease or that somehow U.S. exports will sell themselves without any assistance. But so, you know, the Obama administration, in a lot of ways that didn't get recognized because we did spend so much time talking about issues of war and peace, really did a lot to kind of drag kicking and screaming how the U.S. government engages with the rest of the world into the 21st century, really small d democratizing the process. So you have a lot of areas where non-governmental entities have a lot more influence in how the world works than they did before. Things that became sort of 21st century domestic concerns in the U.S., such as gay rights, were issues that the U.S. really promoted under Obama and helped get a seat at the table globally in ways they didn't have before. And the other thing that the administration did, which frankly brings us right back to the differences we're seeing now, is try to build or actually work quite successfully on issues like climate and on issues like the Iran deal to build interesting new international coalitions of multiple governments coming from multiple different interests aimed at the same set of goals that the administration and its supporters believe were profoundly in the interest of Americans here at home.
Let me just take one more step back before we go down those three avenues that you just mentioned, and get to, I guess, primary basic assumptions in terms of interests, right? I mean, it seems to me that even prior to the definition of a particular administration's foreign policy, right? They need to define what constitutes American interests, right? Because I would imagine that while, you know, I mean, Trump is, I think the Trump administration is going to break rather, like you know, we've both been talking about here, is going to break pretty radically from the assumed interests of what constitutes the assumed interests of the United States, particularly, you know, vis-a-vis the rest of the world. But I would also imagine that there has been at least some nuanced, if not significant, difference as to what constitutes those interests, at least insofar as what our government is supposed to do. You know, and I guess I'm looking at specifically like our corporate interests, you know, U.S. interests, and how much do they outweigh, let's say, labor interests? You know, as we project on the rest of the world.
Yeah. So a thing that happened in the Obama administration that's very interesting in light of the current moment is that debate about sort of what was in the room and what was out of the room when U.S. interests were being considered really happened early on, and then to some extent stopped happening or didn't get pursued very vigorously. You know, trade is a great example where at the beginning of the Obama administration, there were big efforts from labor groups, from environmental groups, and frankly from the Hill to say, hey, we want to be at the table. We want to be part of the trade conversation. And that didn't happen. The administration, while it was welcoming labor to the table on other issues, while it was welcoming environment groups and climate groups to the table on other issues, really chose not only not to bring them in on trade, but also not to bring the Hill in on trade, and really chose to make its trade agenda a pretty small, narrow, and heavily, as you say, and not just corporate focused, but heavily focused on one sector or the sort of Wall Street sector of the American economy as opposed to other sectors. And, you know, they paid the price for that when the large swaths of the Democratic Party, but also the Republican Party, peeled off from them on TPP. And so, you know, an interesting thing that happened in the Obama administration was that you had sort of major, you didn't have a consistent definition of whose interests were American interests all across the board. And that, you know, that's always been a feature of American foreign policy, that we're not, consistency is not our biggest virtue as a country in that regard, to put it mildly. So while you were, you know, the administration did really amazing things, I mean, to take climate with one hand, and then did some pretty harmful things with the other hand. And, you know, you could draw a parallel, by the way, on civil liberties and counterterrorism, where the administration made some really huge strides, you know, whether it was firming up and codifying what should have been an obvious ban on torture, whether it was actually being more open, especially toward the end, about drone strikes and how they were conducted. But on the other hand, you know, building up this enormous targeted killing program and a rationale for why it should proceed with very little scrutiny, which now a new administration is going to feel very free to use. And, you know, there's a way that I think all of those inconsistencies, which again, you don't manage to run a country as big and diverse as ours without having a policy that's plagued by inconsistencies, but they do trace back to sort of, funnily enough, a communications flaw, which is, I think, that there was so much confidence that that all of the inconsistencies could be resolved in the person of Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I think it's an interesting parallel to draw, that as much as Obama and his team really believed in systems, really believed in structures, and did actually put in a lot of effort that they don't get credit for, to make the UN work better, to make the bureaucracy work better, to actually make, you know, sort of the how American foreign policy acts in the world better, more responsive, more connected to on the ground communities, to affected communities. At the same time, the sort of the when push comes to shove, the sort of belief in Obama's unique communicative powers sort of over and above the normal laws of politics, you know, maybe contributed to how we got into the situation in which we now find ourselves.
I mean, not for nothing, but I think that's also a critique that might also work in terms of, at the very least, domestic politics, right? I mean, he famously said in 2009, I got this. Don't worry about it. And then 2010 came and it was a disaster. I mean, I think clearly there was a certain, I don't know if hubris, but overconfidence over what personality itself could do in this arena. I mean, at least if I'm reading your piece correctly.
So a lesson that that all administrations have to learn, and some learn more slowly than others, is that governing is not like campaigning. And you know, you saw, and there was a string of stories that said this, of that the extent to which over the years the Obama team really thought as much about controlling agencies as it did about making use of agencies. And, you know, you saw some of the tensions that arose between the White House and the Pentagon, say, or the frustration between the White House and John Kerry in the second term. And, you know, the irony of Democrats, who are supposed to be the party that believe in government, and, you know, you get into office and you're coming off a campaign where you controlled every word and the message was the medium, and suddenly you're faced with this large, sprawling, and frankly quite uneven bureaucracy. And you have to figure out to what extent you're using it, to what extent you're controlling it, to what extent you're going to trust it to do what it does, to what extent you believe it's trying to undermine you. And I think, as much as, you know, honestly, Sam, part of me wanted to turn down this interview because this seems like a moment where, you know, I would take Obama's flaws over what's happening right now 8 days a week.
Right.
So part of me really feels like this is just not the moment that I'm sort of want to be on air saying anything negative. But at the same time, I do think understanding some of what the interactions among people who, great and well-intentioned as they were also imperfect human beings, and how presidential power and how the system acted on them can help us understand and think strategically about what we're facing right now. I do think it's important to point some of these things out, even though I sort of feel like every single sentence I should have some kind of disclaimer about how small these problems are compared with what we're looking at. Compared with the idea that you're going to start a proxy war against Iran and Yemen, for example.
Exactly. Look, I totally agree, and that's why I wanted you on, is so that we can sort of like have both a nuanced look at what the flaws of the Obama foreign policy is, so that we can actually see just how disastrous this one, the one that we're about to enter into, could be. And I think it's important, you know, hopefully there'll be some of us around at the end of it who can sort of carry this knowledge forward, assuming there's anything left. But so let's dig into that. With that caveat noted, I think everyone, listening, I hope, understands that, in one instance, you know, these are going to be, we're moving to abuse an analogy. You know, these are first world problems that we're talking about, and we're moving into an era where we're going to have real problems, third world wars, maybe. But all right, so let's talk about let's go through this, because you've talked about one of the flaws of the execution of Obama's foreign policy. What was the idea that Obama had as he entered into office in terms of the way that he saw what was problematic about our foreign policy as he entered in?
So the idea that our foreign policy, and here we move specifically to our national security policy and the way we used our military, that specifically we were trying to do too much and do too much in terms of our own people and resources, but also impose too much in terms of pushing too hard on other societies and deciding for them where they should go. And so his observation was, A, the U.S. should be doing less with its military. B, it should be doing less specifically in the Middle East, where he believed the U.S. had an investment that was out of proportion to U.S. interests. And C, that if the U.S. did less, other countries would eagerly jump in and take up the slack. That it would be possible, he believed, in the space of 4 to 8 years, to transition from an international order in which the U.S. was the undisputed leader to an international order in which there were co-leaders all shouldering fairly significant burdens without compromising the structure itself in any way. And so in some ways, it's that third belief about the nature of the system and other countries' willingness and ability to play in it that turned out to be the most problematic.
You used the phrase, which I thought was really, really explained it to me, that the U.S. policy too often sought to speed the movement of the arc of history. Did he perceive American foreign policy, particularly in the context of the Middle East and whatnot, to be that A, benign and earnest of a force? Maybe benign is not the right word, but that earnest of a force that, like, we're just following the arc of history here? Or did he perceive foreign policy to be attempting to intervene in the arc of history? That's my first question. And I guess a subset of that was it the case that when he became president that we had already sort of exhausted our ability to intervene, that we had, you know, I guess along the lines of we had a greater investment in the Middle East than our interests warranted, but had we already exhausted our abilities? Were we basically writing checks that we couldn't cash anymore because we had gone too far in terms of both in terms of exhausting ourselves militarily, but also in terms of exhausting any type of supposed moral leadership?
On your first question, you know, one of Obama's biggest contributions to how we think about and how we formulate American foreign policy, but also one of the ones that guaranteed he would always be somewhat isolated, was his insistence that it wasn't one or the other, it was both. That sometimes the U.S. action in the world was a force for progress doing deeply moral things. Other times it was forcing events in the world in directions that perhaps the people we were pushing on didn't want to go and that perhaps weren't right or just. That he both believed that colonialism had been a problem and that the U.S. could be and had been a force for good in the world. And that's a pretty lonely position across the spectrum of American foreign policy, because you're supposed to believe one or the other, and there's just not a lot of cultural patience for people who insist on both being true. As far as the second, you know, it's interesting to look at Obama's evolution over his time in office. And this, frankly, is a piece that Jeff Goldberg has written a little bit about, but that hasn't been written yet, that I think perhaps Obama comes into office maybe believing that there are a lot of checks written that can't be cashed. And then he put over and over again in the situation, damn it, Mr. President, X has just happened, come up with a check. And so I think one of the ways that you can understand his evolution in office and his embrace of the targeted killing program as a way to try to control the growth of terrorist groups, his sort of dabbling on the edges of Syria, but at the same time choosing not to go in the big ways he was pushed to by a lot of others, is trying to come up, concluding that he wanted, I don't want to beat your cashing checks metaphor to death, but that he maybe wanted or felt the necessity of having more tools than perhaps he had assumed at the beginning.
I'm sorry. He thought he could do more with less.
He discovered that there was more that needed to be done, or there was more that he couldn't escape doing. And I think this, you know, this comes through pretty clearly in some of his interviews in The Atlantic, that it's very hard, I think, for anyone to anticipate the sheer number of things, of world events, that the President of the United States is asked to do something about. And the sheer accretion, both in the U.S., but also overseas. And I think this is a point that people who favor a less active U.S. engagement maybe don't understand, is just how much of the foreign and national security policy establishments in the rest of the world are built on the assumption that the U.S. is going to show up and do something. Whether you like that or whether you don't like it, whether you're built to take advantage of that, or frankly, whether you're built to push back against it, you know, so much of the architecture of how the rest of the world works was assuming that the U.S. would show up and do something in Iraq or in Syria or in Ukraine or in Ivory Coast or in Kenya or in Mali. I could go on and on and on and on. So as an American president, I frankly think Obama, I mean, as Trump, as anyone would, just underestimated the sheer number of places where people would walk in the door and say, if you don't do something, nobody will. And even someone who has a pretty resolute belief that some of the times the answer to that question should be, okay, then nobody will, just the sheer number of things that the U.S. is looked to do something about, and the degree to which it turned out not to be correct that other countries were ready to just jump right in and do it. And so then you were faced with, well, really, okay, no one else is going to do it. Nope, still no one else is going to do anything. And maybe something that wasn't a core U.S. interest if you assumed someone else was going to manage it. If no one else was going to manage it, then it got harder to say, no, we shouldn't do anything. And I think that's the dilemma that Obama faced as time went on.
So when we talk about core interest in that thing, there seems to be two sides of the ledger, right? It's how much will this impact the United States, and how much will it impact, and what are the chances that it will resolve itself? I mean, do I hear that right? Our interests are our interests. And if we only have a, let's say, out of a 10, a level 3 interest in something that's happening somewhere in the world, the idea that someone is going to fix it or not fix it, it doesn't change that level of value to us. It's a 3. Now, I can make a decision based upon the fact that, like, there's a 25% chance that someone's going to fix it, that, you know, and salvage that number 3 level interests of ours, or there's a 95% chance that someone's going to fix it, and that can influence my behavior as well. But theoretically, right, the administration has an immutable sense of what the value of that interest is.
Theoretically, the other problem, and here I think Syria is a good example, is that you have an interest that is only a 3 unless it gets totally out of control and sparks a conflagration in the neighboring countries, in which case suddenly it's a 7. And if you look at Syria and you say, how much of a core security interest does the U.S. have in how Assad treats his citizens? And there, you know, the U.S. has some interest because we say that we have values and we support dignity and human rights, but it's limited. If, however, it turns out that the way the leader of Syria treats his citizenry sparks a civil war, then maybe there's a higher interest because maybe we have some greater concerns with neighboring countries and so on. But that's still, you know, you can make, and people have made, a strong argument that it's manageable. If you knew through omnipotence in advance that the situation in Syria was going to lead to a massive refugee exodus, which would destabilize European politics and contribute to the crippling of the European Union and the falling of friendly governments in a number of Western European countries, giving Russian intelligence agents the opening to push even further, to push out friendly governments. Then suddenly you say to yourself, whoa, that's a major interest of the U.S. And if the Syrian refugee outflow and the accompanying ability of ISIS to and ISIS-affiliated loners to wreak the havoc that they've wreaked in Western Europe with the knock-on effects that have happened, if one had omnipotently been able to see at the beginning that forestalling Syria getting turned into a free fire zone, or parts of Syria getting turned into a free fire zone, could have forestalled that, would that have been a core U.S. interest? Yes, it would.
Right.
Now, you know, are we omnipotent? Can we see that? No, we can't.
And there's
no necessarily mean that anyone should have done anything differently. No, but that is a case of something that started out as a three and has wound up as an eight or nine.
And even if we had that omnipotence and an ability to see, there would still be a debate as to how do we prevent it from growing from a three into a nine, right? Do we support Assad or do we support rebels of who are people who we don't even know necessarily who they are?
Right. The observation, just the observation by itself, doesn't remove the policy dilemma. But how can I put it? It is the case that while you can certainly make the argument that American core interests are immutable, challenges to American core interests are not immutable. If you see what I mean?
Yes. So, okay. So in terms of the Obama administration's agenda, which was to reduce that foreign engagement through our military, you write also to creating this global capacity to deal with some of these things. I mean, you know, I guess the only thing that comes to mind in terms of why, you know, why people could imagine you could do this in 4 to 8 years is, you know, one day there's a Soviet Union, the next day there isn't. And, you know, all I can think of is I had been to Cuba in 2001, I think it was, maybe 2002. And they were still talking about, like, you could still see the scars in that country, and probably today as well, from when the Soviet Union collapsed. You know, that's obviously like a much more intense relationship. But when all of a sudden that goes away, everybody's on their own. They're having to figure out how they're going to manage without them. But that you can't replicate that when the United States just sort of like slowly tries to pull back, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting analogy. I mean, first in that, you know, certainly nobody would ever argue that the collapse of the Soviet Union was how you wanted anything to change. One of the reasons, by the way, that you would never argue that is how angry it turned out ordinary Russians were about how quickly their country collapsed as they saw it and what came in its aftermath. Which is, of course, a force and an anger and a feeling of being unfairly put out of their rightful place in the world that has allowed Vladimir Putin to control the country so effectively and to drive it in, you know, some of the problematic directions that he has in terms of how they treat their neighbors. And this is not a direct analogy I would ever make, but I do think there's no question that there's a segment of the American public that derived its feeling of security from a set of feelings about American power and American omnipotence. And that the combination of Obama being elected president on this platform of don't do stupid stuff, we've been doing too much, we don't have an infinite amount of power to influence everything in the world at the same time.
Leading from behind, apologizing,
combined with the economic crisis of 2008-2009, wherein, I mean, Americans weren't crazy to feel like suddenly they had less power, both as a society and in their own lives, than they had before. And I do think that we have consistently underestimated the degree to which a segment of our voting public draws its sense of security and its sense of place in the world from a set of feelings about American power. And Obama went straight up against that. And I don't think we necessarily understood the political consequences that was going to have, or how, as you just said, by mentioning the apologizing and leading from behind canards, how Obama's views about how the U.S. should lead in the world were going to get wrapped into the racialized campaign that was run against him for 8 years. And so I think that through absolutely no fault of his own, his views about how to change U.S. national security policy got wrapped very neatly into a critique of him and were, frankly, used as a talking point that, while itself being apparently totally free of all the horrible racism that was featured in much of the campaign against him, nonetheless was used to reinforce those arguments.
I mean, I think that's a really important thing for people to keep in mind, that how much that plays, so that when we see Donald Trump trying to get into some type of fight with the Prime Minister of Australia, that, you know, that's part of making America great again, right? I mean, you know, and we can, I don't want to get into a tangent about sort of the cultural loss that the supposed white working class, in addition to the economic loss that they have suffered, part of that cultural loss would be like, you know, I go to the bar and when I want to start cheering, we're number one, you know, people look at me and they go, are you sure? Maybe we're number four now or something. And that's a problem. Well, but let me ask just one more thing too, in terms of that Russian analogy, and I wasn't even contemplated what it would mean domestically in terms of the way that people perceive themselves because their country is no longer, you know, one of the superpowers. But I was thinking in terms of the notion of, is it possible there are people in the administration today who think like, look, it's better to rip the Band-Aid off. I mean, on some level, right? They're just basically, they're following a version of, you know, if Obama was not disengaging, but was trying to maybe lean a little bit less forward into the world and allow other entities, as you described, both NGOs and other governments, to sort of fill that void. It seems to me that to the extent that we understand what's going on with the Trump administration, and I think you've articulated this, is that they just want to rip the Band-Aid off and just say, like, you know, we're going to have one presence in this world, and it's going to be a sort of militaristic resource extraction presence. And the rest of it, have at it. We don't care. I mean, it's...
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a very clean... Obama believed in the idea of a cooperative, non-zero-sum, rules-based international order, and believed in it because he believed that those characteristics served core U.S. interests. The Trump people don't believe that those characteristics serve core U.S. interests. They believe core U.S. interests are served by a winner-takes-all, transactional, what we call mercantilist, which is to say that you're out there sort of pursuing your own economic interests at the expense of everybody else. There is no system. There's just what you can sell to other people, or what you can force other people to buy from you. And they believe that very explicitly. They're moving toward it very explicitly. We also, I want to point out that Trump's chief strategist has been, you know, obligingly explicit that, number one, he believes in heightening the contradictions, as Lenin would say. So, yes, let's rip off as many Band-Aids as possible. And number two, that in addition to this, you know, kind of zero-sum view of the world, that they have a very, to quote the New York Times, dark cultural view of the world, that it's Christians versus everybody else. So the whole notion of cooperation and rules-based systems if you believe that certain countries or religions or regions or ethnicities are inherently either incapable or unworthy of participating in a rules-based system, then, you know, I think something that we've failed to appreciate is the extent to which the inauguration of Trump and his team just removed the pillars from the American structure of a rules-based international order. And however much of a critique of that you might have from the left, the pillars that you could even hang your critique on are now gone, if you will. And we're watching, I mean, in slow motion, although it certainly doesn't feel very slow, we're watching the edifice. The reason the edifice is falling away so fast is that the pillars are gone.
And we thought in the 90s that we were seeing a new world order, right? I mean, this is...
Right, but back to your point about the Soviet Union, these are people who rejected the new world order of the 90s and who saw the end of the Cold War as an opportunity to go back to some ideas about the world order from the 20s and 30s.
Well, I mean, I think this is... a little bit, are people a little bit nerve-wracked in the in your world, Heather?
Yeah, they are. You know, in my world, I mean, we don't normally talk in a very apocalyptic way. Many people think very highly of Secretary of Defense Mattis and felt that that would be a major checking influence. You know, there were sort of mixed views of Rex Tillerson. But what we've seen over the last week is policy is coming out of the White House. And again, back to my sort of why the Obama experience is highly relevant. The Obama White House, spent a lot of its time driving the agencies, and policy was not driven by the agencies. It was driven by the White House. And that's been a trend over decades. It wasn't something new to the Obama administration, but the Trump folks have walked in and picked up the tools that were there and frankly taken them to the next extreme. And, you know, what you're seeing is that the departments have maybe there's less institutional power to push back than all of us fondly imagined there was.
What are those tools? Or, I mean, it just seems to me that, you know, you've just got literally some people walking in who don't have that much experience. You also don't have, I mean, I guess the tools are right, like would be the NSC and others. But what are those tools, A, and B, how much of this is a function of the agencies not being able to staff up?
Well, I think we all, you know, I mean, yes, it's catastrophic that the agencies aren't staffed up, and that's causing, you know, some of these executive orders to have, you know, mistakes in them that are funny, except that the whole thing's not really funny. But I think all of us, you know, sort of institutionalists and who've spent time working in the agencies or at the White House and know the process, all of us sort of assumed, well, you wouldn't do something that 1,000 State Department officers signed a cable saying you shouldn't do. That you wouldn't do something that your whole senior staff was opposed to. You wouldn't do something you wouldn't promulgate an executive order without consulting the head of the relevant agency. The process, the tools all assume that agencies play a role in policy formation. If instead agencies play no role in policy formation, but agencies only play a role in policy implementation, you know, then the tools that are there are whether and to what extent agencies are willing or able to refuse to implement policy. And that's a very hard thing to ask your bureaucracy.
Mm. All right. Well, so lastly, Heather, and I know we're a little bit off topic from the flaws of the Obama foreign policy, but I think that is a certain inevitability, right? Like you say, you know. What are people in your community when they look at like potential flashpoints? What's the one thing that everybody is focusing on? I mean, or if there's one thing, I mean, or is it? I mean, what is? I don't know, first order fears?
So, you know, every day there's a new one, honestly. But so trying to be a little more, I mean, so big picture, when you have a senior staffer in the White House telling the media that war with China is inevitable, that's very worrying.
We were just and let me just tell people, you're referring to Bannon. And I think you're referring to Bannon in an interview that he did. And we have that. We'll play that audio in a later in the program. He was talking to Steve Edwards of the Heritage Foundation on Breitbart Radio in March of this year, saying that we're bound to go to war with China in 5 to 10 years over those Pacific islands.
You know, I mean, and if you compare that to a president who believes that, say, full equality for men and women is inevitable, or a president who believes that curing cancer is inevitable, and you think about what it means when your political leadership tells you that something is inevitable, you should be very worried about that. So that's sort of very big picture, but because, you know, I'm sure your listeners don't need to be reminded that China is, of course, not only the largest country on the planet, biggest economy on the planet, nuclear weapons, those Pacific Islands it views as its home turf, so it's not gonna sort of half-heartedly play around if there's a war connected to them. So just to explain why that's an existentially big deal. The two things in addition
can
to
I
that,
remind
that
you
I,
that we are number one, so
hey, that's not fair. Your producers are laughing. I don't know the listeners can hear, but somebody's got to be laughing. But two things, I mean, because there's just an avalanche of stuff, but two things that are happening right now that I would draw people's attention to. And one is an effort reported, I think, by Reuters today to change programming on countering violent extremism to countering violent Islam.
Literally rebranding it from countering violent extremism to countering violent Islam. Yeah.
So just two things. One is I invite you to imagine what it would sound like if that was countering violent Episcopalianism. And point two, you may think to yourself, oh, that's just a branding exercise. But what that means is the end of federal government tracking and efforts to prevent and contain right-wing violence, that it's explicitly dropping out of the definition of what the DHS, DOJ task force does, looking at right-wing violence in this country. So you should be very worried about that. And you should also, of course, be worried about what this kind of targeting and demonization does to our Muslim friends and neighbors, and what it does to kids growing up here, you know, who at least in theory were used to the idea that they were just citizens like all the rest of us, and that their religion didn't make them more or less a citizen than the rest of us. And then the last thing that I want to mention that has popped up in the last 24 hours is, Trump unleashed a tweet storm about Iran last night, which was quite extraordinary the Australia stuff and the Mexico stuff were also extraordinary, but the idea of addressing that kind of belligerence toward a country that has a hostile relationship with us is fairly unprecedented in modern American history.
Heather, always a pleasure.
Have me on something more cheerful next time, maybe.
Yes, we will definitely. If you have a sense of when that will happen,
yeah. Well, there is that.
Well,
but thanks for having me.
No, yes, I mean it's fascinating stuff, and I appreciate your giving us a both a good look back and a at least a somewhat clear look forward, to the extent that one can predict or be aware of where some potential landmines, and I don't know if I'm using that as a metaphor, will be. Heather Herbert, Director of New Models of Change at the New America Foundation, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
In a certain way, I'm a director of a new model of change, too. In a certain sense.
I had... In terms of programmatically, I had anticipated that interview being a little bit shorter, but I found it fascinating, and then it moved into disturbing.
There was this guy, Chang, who wouldn't give me a loan once. Very rude guy. And then Steve says we have to have a war with them. So what are you going to do? Wouldn't give me a bank loan. Wouldn't give me a bank loan. By the way, never forgot that. Chinese, very devious people. They're clever, but they're devious. And Steve says we need to have a war.
Oh, my God.
It's true. Pick your poison.
I mean,
what'd you say?
You need to have a nickname that Trump has for Steve.
Well, think about that.
I mean, here's the dilemma, folks. And I don't,
Steve,
we don't
no
I feel like we're all laughing now and joking around. Like it's, I don't even know if you call it gallows humor, right? Because, sometimes just we're hanging around the gallows. It's like, I don't know. Do people laugh when they're like, they feel like they're walking on,
the noose like, is around my neck. Ha ha. You're such an idiot. Look at you. You orange face. Putting a noose on me.
I think this definitely qualifies as gallows humor because this presidency does feel like you're serving a sentence in prison.
Yes. But there's also an element of risk. It's like you're just walked into the middle of a frozen lake and you just start hearing like, am I hearing cracking? And you're just there and you know you're so far from the edges of the lake that if it really is cracking, you're sort of screwed.
Yeah,
so you're just out there, you're just going like, I don't know, is it cracking? Maybe
sounds like it's cracking.
It could be cracking. And
I told Mr. Chen many, many years ago that I was going to get elected president. And then he said, what about the tape where you brag about grabbing pussy? I said, doesn't matter. Still going to win. And then there's going to be an alcoholic neo-fascist with a Greek complex, and he's going to lead us to war with you. So maybe you should have thought differently about giving me that loan. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a date with my first daughter to go out on.
I think the laughing is just a coping mechanism.
Yes.
That everyone is using. I mean, you cannot go through every you cannot live the rest of your life and go through every single day thinking about all of this stuff.
And the psychology is people adjust to circumstances rather quickly, and I think this
Jared
is sort of part
didn't
of
want us
oh,
to go
yes.
to war.
We're
but
all
it
gonna
was,
be it's gonna be this is
Jared listen. Didn't want us to go to war, but it was Shabbat. So what are you gonna do? Steve knows timing.
I can't wait until we have to like it's do you want to order take in freedom food tonight? We're gonna get some chicken fried freedom rice and some
no one outside of the
scallion
White House.
Freedom pancakes. You know what, I think we should play Ian's interview if not tomorrow, I guess next week, because it's just going to be we're already way over. So, and Gorsuch is not going to go anywhere. I mean, the...
And neither is fascism, by the
right,
way.
Right, we're going to talk about his youth. And to be fair, look, all of us were young once. And I'm sure there's many people in the audience who, when they were in college, they produced clubs about things that they are embarrassed about now today. Like, I mean, how many of our listeners probably set up their own fascist clubs?
Yeah, I'm sure it was quite common.
There was probably, I would be surprised if we didn't have a significant portion of our clubs who didn't come up with like, you know, Friends of Pol Pot clubs or, you know.
That's a completely different thing.
Right. So you can't. Youthful indiscretion. I am sure there were a lot of things in his life that as he grew older and changed his attitude towards liberals and whatnot. I'm sure there's plenty of evidence where he sort of came around to thinking like, maybe fascist forever clubs are not.
It sounds like you're writing a Senate testimony.
Exactly.
The Pella Water War, Steve? Whatever. It's fine. Look, there's someone at ESPN said that I looked shorter than 6'3", so I'm going to tweet at them. Why don't you order the nuke on China? Just go ahead. Jared's at Shabbat. I asked him, I said, does he want to invade China? He seems to like the yellow men, but he's doing his Jew day. So yeah, I don't get to grope Ivanka. He doesn't get to have a say about World War III.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
Major fucking time. We are number one.
At least, I mean, you got to be thankful for at least like the ability, like, can you imagine how Heather feels? Like, at least we can joke about it. Like, she can't go on and she has to maintain some, like, measure of reservedness and, you know.
I'm the director of new models and strategic planning at an August think tank. I'm a guy who's read some fucking books about Greece, and I had a Breitbart podcast, so I'd invite you to kindly leave, because I'm pretty much going to take command of the entire U.S. foreign policy structure. Also going to wink at right-wing terrorism while I'm at it, but you have a nice day. Why don't you curl up and do, what do you guys call it? You call it self-care? Get a Haagen-Dazs, watch some fucking Netflix, because I got the keys now. All right, later, darling.
Jesus. All right, folks. Hey, it's your membership that makes the show possible. I mean,
take your poison.
I feel like we could get like a sponsorship at this point for like, you know. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to live in Canada?
Yeah, seriously. How about a sponsorship from China Today? We welcome your barbarian management, Comrade Xi.
That is a copy for barbarian management.
Barbarian management membership level.
Become a member to join the Majority Report. I don't even have the, I can't even. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Yeah, we're going to go into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number.
I say one last thing. You know, Paul
fun
Ryan.
Fun half is
going
to be so fun.
Paul Ryan, it might disrupt putting children and elderly people on the streets if we have World War III.
Yeah, that's
like, I'm just
actually
saying, like, don't you want to do it at a more slower pace?
The one thing that we could probably leverage with Paul Ryan is like, it can be super hard to cut Medicare if we're in the middle of a war.
Oh, there'll be a lot going on. He's like, I never thought of that. It's a great fucking point.
What else? Oh, leave us a review on iTunes if you can. That's very helpful. Always fun.
I should totally do that.
Good luck. We're gonna probably start our GoFundMe for the 23-inch thick cement walls we're gonna be wanting to be broadcasting from. Just gonna figure out how to have like one little hole for the coaxial cable that comes in. All right, 646-257-3920. We're gonna play that Ian Millhiser interview next week because we're just overloaded, and we'll take your IMs. See you on the fun half. Got a lot of fun sound, including that interview with Steve Bannon. You know, predicting war in China in 5 to 10 years, which was almost a year ago. It was 11 months ago. And
Confucius say what, Steve? Get it? I mean,
don't you think it's inevitable we're going to have a war with China in 5 to 10 years? I mean, just as inevitable as I'm going to be the second most powerful man in the world, probably, within 9 months. Bye. We got to go to break. Coming up, Goldline.
Dude.
See you guys in the fun hour.